So we're going to conclude this hour with a wide-ranging discussion on what the implications of what's going on in Libya might mean to actually other nations nearby, and policy implications for the entire world's approach to the Middle East now. We've been speaking with a variety of voices this morning, examining the emotional and policy implications from the developments in the past 24 hours in Libya. Here to talk about all of it is Anthony Shadid, Beirut Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times, and also on the line, Michael Waleed Hanna, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation. Michael, good morning to you first.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, anything you're just dying to say with the developments that have taken place in the last 24 hours? And then let's look at the sort of regional implications here.
Sure. I mean, I think there's obviously a huge symbolic resonance, and that symbolic resonance is in here in Cairo as well. I think that it's a necessary step, a helpful step towards a political transition. And in terms of turning to political discourse, as long as the fight continued, it's not clear that it's over yet, but as long as the military struggle continued, I think that privileged those with arms. If we see shifting to a new phase, then I think you could see the emergence of the beginning of actual national political discourse, and that's a good thing for Libya.
Century Foundation fellow Michael Waleed Hanna is in Cairo this morning. In Beirut is Anthony Shadid, Beirut Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. What do you need to get off your chest, Anthony Shadid, before we talk about the regional implications here?
Well, I think as Michael pointed out, there is a resonance from Colonel Gaddafi's death, and we've already seen it today in Syria, where some people are chanting, it's your turn next, Bashar, and that's a reference to, of course, the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. I think that resonance is going to be felt for some time in the region. I think there is also, I have to say, perhaps, I don't want to say by any means the dominant sentiment out there. There's perhaps a little bit of a revulsion in the way that Colonel Gaddafi was killed. I think some people question whether this was, in fact, justice, if it wouldn't have been better for him to go on trial for some kind of courtroom proceeding that might have served as an instrument of reconciliation. You have heard that occasionally in both. I don't want to say it's dominant, how prevalent necessarily is, but it is, it's being heard out there.
Stepping back in the history of the last decade, Anthony Shadid, the Middle East suddenly has two really important, object lessons in terms of regime change. In the case of Libya and Iraq, there are similarities and differences, of course. What lessons do you think the region might take from what happened in Iraq versus what needs to happen now in Libya? And then we'll talk about Egypt and Tunisia in a moment. Anthony?
I'd be really reluctant to put Iraq in the category of the uprising and the tumult that we're seeing right now. It was just such an experience that was so completely overwhelmed by the American invasion and the American occupation that followed. Iraqi society, I think, was torn apart by the experience that ensued there. And if the lessons we're going to learn, perhaps if we're going to try to draw any lessons from Iraq and point them toward Libya, I think it's the necessity of trying to forge some kind of national consensus or a consensus that will be able to transcend these divisions of sect and ethnicity. Libya does have some very, very stark challenges ahead. It's not only divisions between different clans, but there's also the issues of regional distinctions, how the resources of the country are going to be shared, what role political Islam will play in the body politic that emerges there. These are very serious challenges, and I think we're probably almost better off not looking to Iraq for any examples or lessons, but trying to see Libya on its own terms and how it's going to reconcile itself with those challenges it faces.
Michael, we have the first free elections for Tunisia coming up this Saturday, and it kind of calls into stark contrast the differences between all these different countries that are involved in Arab Spring movements. And yet some things are the same. For many of these countries, it wasn't just civil liberties that made them rise up. But for many of the young people, it was bread and butter issues. It was the fact that they were jobless, unemployed, and without any real prospects for the future. How does that get addressed by what's going on with these elections or what's happening in Libya?
Well, I do think they shared a lot of common traits. I mean, I think localized trends pushed various issues to different degrees in each country. But you did have the same sort of ideas about corruption, about repression, about torture that animated these movements in various countries. And I do think we're seeing something interesting in the Middle East. I mean, people are paying attention to what happens in other countries. And, the Tunisian elections that are going to happen on Sunday are an important benchmark. And people here in Egypt are paying attention to those issues and what's happening in the elections. The fact that there's going to be out-of-country voting. It sets certain precedents. And in the Tunisia example, it seems like it's going to be a good one at that. And so that's quite helpful because there is something synergistic going on among all these different movements, despite the fact that localized issues are shaping each country. There's a real interest in what's happening elsewhere, and there's a real sense that precedent is being set, and examples and lessons are being drawn from what happens in other places.
Century Foundation fellow Michael Wahid Hanna, who is in Cairo. Yet, you know, it seems to me when voters go to the polls in Tunisia, they can certainly look at the chaos in Iraq and be repulsed by that. They can look at the situation in Libya and wonder about what's going to happen next. If you're a Syrian, though, and a Yemeni, and you look at the situation in Libya, you're likely to draw the conclusion, well, if the Arab League doesn't ask NATO to come in and the international community isn't willing to intervene in some way, there's no hope for any of us in our countries. Michael Wahid Hanna?
I think the Libya example is somewhat sui generis in the fact that we're not going to see a confluence and convergence of interest in the same way as happened in Libya, in Syria or Yemen. And I think people are broadly cognizant of that fact. There's just no possibility for any sort of foreign military intervention. And I think people are not working on any assumptions that that might
right.
be a possibility. And I do think that they're persevering on their own terms. I mean, I do think that they see hope in the possibility of long-term struggle. So I don't know that it's total pessimism. I think they are quite aware of the odds, difficult odds that they face. And that's part of the, you know, part of the broader struggle. But, you know, I don't think that the Libya example is going to resonate in terms of the sort of
right.
Armed military intervention that happened from abroad.
Well, some lessons are generalizable, some not. Michael Wahid Hanna, fellow at the Century Foundation. Final thoughts, Anthony Shadid, before we go?
Well, I think it's interesting what Michael said, and I think he's right. There is probably an encouragement that we're seeing from Libya with the Syrian protests, but it is I think the lesson to take away from Syria is the resilience of those protests. There isn't hopelessness right there, but there is a sense that this is a long struggle. And I think this is something we take away from all these Arab revolts and revolutions, is that this is a very broad struggle that's going to last years
all
rather
right.
than months.
Anthony Shadid, Beirut Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. We leave you with the voices and the sounds from where it all began, Tunisia.
There's plenty of demonstration in the capital, in many cities, so people are still going to the streets and demonstrating.
We want a new constitution! We want a new constitution!
They don't just riot. They riot with their mobile phones out. They riot taking pictures. Right away, they want to post those pictures to their friends all over Tunis.
We think that what is happening in Tunis is a lesson for all oppressive regimes and all corrupt regimes in the Arab world. And we want them to learn a lesson from what is going on in Tunis.
Give us your views at 8778-MY-TAKE. I'm Celeste Headlee.
From Tunis to Tripoli, I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.